Welcome to episode 2 of the Anti-Doping Podcast, presented by the Partnership for Clean Competition. I'm Dr. Marie McNeely, and today we'll be chatting with our guest, John Coyles from Major League Baseball. Support for this episode is provided by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, or USADA. USADA is the national anti-doping organization in the U.S. for Olympic, Paralympic, and Pan American sport, protecting clean athletes and the integrity of sport. You can learn more at USADA.org. And listeners, in today's show, John is going to share a lot of great information and insights. So, John, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. How are you?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We are excited to chat with you about some of your experiences and the work that you do. But let me start with a brief introduction for our listeners. So, listeners, John is Vice President of Drug Health and Safety Programs at Major League Baseball. And John, we want to learn more about all of the awesome things that you've got on your plate right now. So can you start by telling us more about what you actually do there at Major League Baseball?
Sure. In my role, I oversee all aspects of Major League Baseball's anti-doping programs. There are 7 of them. That management includes the oversight of our scientific experts, our medical consultants, our multiple sample collection agents, and the 3 testing laboratories that we have a relationship with. In addition to the specific anti-doping work, I am a lawyer by trade. I'm part of the team that is involved with the collective bargaining process with the Major League Baseball Players Association and also our umpire union. We negotiate the collective bargaining agreements with those 2 entities typically every 5 years. But with respect to the anti-doping program that is collectively bargained with the union, we do that on an annual basis. Here at the commissioner's office, which is the actual entity that I am employed by, we work directly with Major League Baseball club officials on a variety of issues that fall into the legal anti-doping, player development, and player health categories. And in addition to the anti-doping work over the years, that role has expanded a little bit. I'm also involved with our concussion policies, our efforts on the smokeless tobacco front, strength and conditioning and nutrition, and also most recently, mental health and domestic violence treatment policies. And one of my favorite parts of the job, in addition to working within the baseball industry, the baseball world, I also have been lucky enough to become the main point of contact and the liaison with outside anti-doping entities like WADA, USADA, and also the Partnership for Clean Competition.
Very cool. Well, John, you touched on a lot of awesome programs that the MLB has. Can you tell us maybe a little bit more detail about these 7 anti-doping programs you mentioned?
Sure. Well, just by virtue of the reach of Major League Baseball and also the different classifications of employees that are subject to different anti-doping programs, we've had to create different programs that include little nuances and different procedures to make sure that they're applicable and appropriate. The most well-known program that we have is our Joint Drug Prevention and Treatment Program. That is the policy that applies to all 40-man roster players or the major league players and also the players that are on a major league contract that are down in the minor leagues. That is the policy that, again, receives the most PR and the most coverage. We have an obligation under U.S. federal law to negotiate with the union that represents those players. And since 2007, we have taken the unprecedented step of reopening that agreement, taking a look at it, reviewing it, and updating it on an annual basis. Outside of that program is our minor league drug prevention and treatment program. There are approximately 7,500 minor league players in the United States and around the world. We unilaterally administer that program and update that program on an annual basis as well. Over the years, we've been quite successful at making the minor league drug program consistent with the joint drug program. We feel it's important to have similar rules across the board, but we do not have an obligation to negotiate or collectively bargain the minor league program with any union. Beyond those 2 programs that apply to players, we have multiple programs that apply to amateur prospects, those players that are coming up into the Major League Baseball system. We have a U.S. prospect program that drug tests and educates players that are coming up through college and high school. And we also have a similar program for international prospects that come out of areas like the Dominican Republic and Venezuela. We have 2 programs that apply to non-playing personnel. We have an umpire drug testing and alcohol program that subjects our game officials to pregame testing to make sure that there's no banned substances in their bodies. And we also have a program that applies to coaches and managers and other non-playing personnel for Major League Baseball and our 30 clubs. And finally, our most recent program is a program that we're very proud of. there are a number of independent trainers that operate in the Dominican Republic and Latin America, and we've been working very closely with them to create a clean game and a level playing field for all players that are coming up through that system. We have created a trainer partnership program that includes a large number of anti-doping tests conducted on a random basis throughout the year. And that's conducted and administered independent of the other prospect programs that we have in place.
Excellent. Well, thank you for giving us more detail about these programs, giving us an idea of the landscape of the anti-doping programs there at MLB. But I have to ask, John, how did you initially get interested or involved in this area of sports law and anti-doping programs?
Well, I was very lucky to get involved with this, not only with Major League Baseball, which is a great group to work with, but being able to be involved in their anti-doping programs is something that I pinch myself pretty regularly. I realize how lucky I am to be able to get to do this work. I enjoy it, but I also feel that it's very important. On a personal level, I came up through college and law school at a time when anti-doping and doping control was really at the forefront. I was a track and field athlete in college, and unfortunately, some of the biggest stars in track and field at the time when I was competing ultimately got caught up in anti-doping rule violations. I was in college around the time that the Sydney Olympics. And then when transitioning into law school, I had a great, wonderful sports law professor that I took multiple classes with. But a big topic of discussion in those classes and just in the sports world generally was the Belco investigation, which impacted both Major League Baseball and also the track and field world. So for professional and personal reasons, it's always been something that I've felt very strongly about and something that I never really thought early on that I'd have an opportunity to get involved with, but I'm very happy that I did. And then ultimately, the opportunity to work for Major League Baseball presented itself pretty early on in my professional career, and I've been at this job ever since.
Awesome. And I think you can tell that you're just so passionate about the work that you do. So what are some of the things that you enjoy most about your job and working in this field in general?
Again, I can't say it enough that Major League Baseball is a great place to work, obviously has a sports aspect to it, but the people and the culture of working with this office is really just a great situation for me personally and for my colleagues. But I also enjoy working within the anti-doping industry, which expands beyond the baseball industry, but also involves beyond just the professional sports industry. Anti-doping is certainly a niche industry, but it's a very collaborative one. I think everyone that is lucky enough to have roles that are similar to mine feel that we're all in this together. We have very similar goals, even though the sports and the structures may be slightly different. A really good example of that is an organization called the Partnership for Clean Competition, or otherwise known as the PCC. That was a group that Major League Baseball was involved in forming about 10 years ago. We formed the PCC with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, the NFL, and the U.S. Olympic Committee. And before the PCC was formed, we would all do our own research and look to make improvements and advancements in the anti-doping world on our own individual tracks. But we realized back in 2008 that taking a collaborative approach, a collective approach, could benefit the greater good. So we formed the PCC as a research consortium where we can work together, try to improve and make change, and then ultimately we can all benefit in the same way. So I just really like that perspective. It's something where we all have our own individual jobs to do, but we can really create a change and create an impact when we work together on work that is very important and very beneficial to everyone that's in the amateur and professional sporting world.
Definitely. So can you give our listeners a sense or maybe an example of one of these things that's come out of this collaborative work that you're doing with the PCC with other sports leagues?
Well, the PCC operates round the clock, year round. The way that the process works is research grants are considered, proposals are submitted to the PCC, and there are two aspects. There is a scientific advisory board, which is a group of the world's top scientists that will review these grants and make recommendations to the Board of Governors. The Board of Governors has a representative from each of those four institutions to help create the PCC, and they will make the final decision on whether a grant should be approved and paid out. And then essentially, the researchers that are provided the grants do the work. But ultimately, as opposed to the research benefits and the findings just applying to one individual institution, on the contrary, the research is shared with all of the founding members and the supporters of the PCC and will benefit all of us equally. While research is very important and while anti-doping science is in a very strong place right now, there's always an opportunity for growth. There's always an opportunity for improvement. And the PCC is really the only institution in the world that will support that research and make sure that the ball continues to move forward and that anti-doping science continues to improve and get stronger and get better. And in addition to the actual research over the last few years, there's been a clear understanding within the organizations that support the PCC that it's also crucial that the next step be taken with the research to make sure that it's put in place within the laboratories that we use, and is also put in a place where anti-doping organizations can benefit from that. So there's been a recent push to translate that research into actual tangible improvements and figuring out ways to translate the research from just research findings that are published to actual things that can be applied to anti-doping organizations and the laboratories that we work with.
Well, John, that sounds like a phenomenal opportunity. And we spoke about kind of the MLB in general as a great place to work. So can you give our listeners a sense of what it's like to work at one of these exceptional sport organizations?
Absolutely. Happy to talk about that because it's something that I really feel fortunate to be in a position to serve that role. Working for Major League Baseball or any professional sports organization, it is regularly exciting and it's certainly an honor. I'm really fortunate to work with a team of incredible attorneys here on this end, and we are really at the forefront of the most important issues in baseball today. Through the strong policies that we've worked to develop and improve over the last decade or so, we're able to protect the integrity of baseball, and that's very important to me and our fans. And in my specific role, I'm also lucky enough to work with the world's top scientific experts at 3 WADA-accredited laboratories in North America that we have relationships with, and who have certainly helped MLB establish what I view as the toughest and most comprehensive anti-doping program in U.S. pro sports.
Wonderful. And can you tell us a little bit about how you got to this point, maybe the history of how these programs were developed or came to be?
Sure. Well, I can dust off the history books here. Major League Baseball unilaterally established our first anti-doping program in 2001. That was that unilaterally administered minor league program that I previously mentioned. And then very soon thereafter, Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association agreed to the first ever anti-doping program at the major league level in 2003. I was hired in June 2007, which by happenstance was a pretty significant time in Major League Baseball's anti-doping history. The Mitchell Report, which was the report of an independent investigation by former Senator Mitchell, came out in December 2007, and that may have been the most important or crucial point in time within the anti-doping movement within Major League Baseball. The reason for that is that the Mitchell Report included a number of recommendations that we adopted very quickly and were first put in place early in 2008. Those recommendations included independent administration of our anti-doping program, a Department of Investigations, which would be charged with investigating anti-doping rule violations outside of positive drug tests, the annual review process, which I previously mentioned, and a number of other strong recommendations that are still in place today. And then since the Metro report came out, we have taken a look at our program every year. We've agreed to and imposed pretty significant annual improvements that included over the years being the first league to start blood testing for human growth hormone. We imposed a longitudinal profile program, I believe it was 2012, that was a very sophisticated and important change that took a look at exogenous steroids that could potentially be administered by our athletes. Unfortunately, in 2013, we had to conduct a pretty large-scale investigation into an anti-aging clinic in South Florida called Biogenesis that resulted in a significant number of suspensions at the end of that year, where performance-enhancing substances were being distributed to a number of our athletes. We were able to prove violations of our anti-doping policy through non-analytical evidence, which is evidence of PED use outside of a positive drug test. But that was another example of how we took a negative situation and made significant improvements through agreements with our Players Association to increase the number of tests that we conduct and increase the strength of the rules that we have in place on the anti-doping front. And while that investigation resulted in us putting our policies in very strong places, we have continued to make annual improvements through the review and update process that was recommended by Senator Mitchell back in 2007.
Excellent. And it sounds like it's really exciting to be able to see these programs continue to evolve and get better over time. So is there something else that you're working on, or maybe a particular program or project that you have going on right now that you're really excited about?
Well, I never thought I would say this, but I'm very excited to be involved in the product development and sample collection equipment business.
Ooh.
Through the design and development of something that we think can improve the overall anti-doping landscape. And we have been involved in a project with the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency over the last 2 years that we're about to launch and we're very excited about. In mid-2016, there was a New York Times story, and our office is based in New York. So whenever something is on the front page of the New York Times, we take notice of it. But it was talking about the Russian doping scandal that involved breaking into what was supposed to be tamper-proof or tamper-evident equipment that we utilize in our programs. That story, which was very concerning to us, resulted in us discussing how we could potentially avoid these issues in our world and how we can make improvements with respect to the anti-doping equipment that we utilize. So over the last 2 years, USADA and MLB have worked together to design and develop improved anti-doping equipment that were essentially ready to take to market. Now, MLB and USADA are not in the specimen collection selling business, so we have worked to create an independent third party to market and develop that, but it's very exciting. We have worked very hard to improve and innovate our anti-doping programs every year, but the actual equipment that is being used hasn't really been improved in some time. So we've taken this concerning negative situation and spun it in a way that will hopefully result in improved, more user-friendly, more athlete-friendly equipment that also includes some pretty exciting technologies and, most importantly, security and technology that will improve the tamper evidence, tamper security of the equipment that will be utilized certainly in our anti-doping programs, but hopefully other anti-doping entities and pro sports leagues will take advantage of it as well.
Absolutely. And I think it's really exciting to see more of these interorganizational collaborations taking place. Things like MLB working with USADA to tackle some of these really tough problems in anti-doping. And we have a special guest with us on the show today from the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, or USADA. Dr. Matthew Fedorik is Chief Science Officer at USADA. So Matt, can you tell us a little bit about the mission of USADA and why it's important for your organization to support anti-doping research?
Yeah, so obviously we want to detect and deter doping in sport, but more than that, we want to protect the health of athletes and the integrity of sport. So it works hand in hand that the laboratories are a real key partner in that. And one way to bolster the efforts of detection and deterrence is to increase the ability of the labs to detect prohibited substances. And by sponsoring research to improve those techniques, we're really increasing the deterrence effect of the work that we do.
Absolutely. So Matt, can you tell us about how you found your position at USADA and what it's been like working there?
One day I got a call from our CEO, Travis Tigert, who wanted me to come down and interview for the job at USADA. And I was in Colorado Springs 3 weeks later working for USADA. And it's been an amazing experience and opportunity. It's presented a lot of challenges along the way, but I've learned a tremendous amount about the science in order to advance the fight against doping.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful opportunity. And Matt, I understand that USADA was among the organizations that originally helped develop the PCC as an anti-doping research collaborative. So can you tell us about the history and why it was important to form this partnership for anti-doping research?
Sure. USADA is one of the founding members of PCC. And when we were founded in 2000, we ran our own scientific research program. And it really made sense as the years went on to partner with the USOC, partner with Major League Baseball, NFL, in order to really bolster our research efforts and work more effectively with the anti-doping scientific community. Research is expensive, and we are more effective if we work together at pooling our resources to focus on the really critical aspects of where we want to prioritize our efforts. And by becoming a partner in that effort, we can fight and effectively fight doping in sport.
Certainly. And Matt, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And I know there are a lot of challenges when it comes to fighting doping in sport, particularly at this intersection of law and sports and anti-doping. So, John, do you have a favorite challenge that you want to share with me and our listeners today that you've experienced in your career?
Sure. Well, I don't know if favorite and challenge want to go together, but certainly one aspect of the job that I really enjoy is that the issues and the challenges that you face are different on a pretty regular basis and really requires you to take a step back and be strategic with how you respond. But one challenge that is near and dear to my heart and something that I feel very strongly about that is a concern has been a concern for some time and will continue to be a concern until some change is able to be made is the lack of regulation of the dietary supplement industry in the United States. Unfortunately, because of that lack of regulation, products that are utilized by our athletes can be contaminated, and that contamination can lead to the unintentional administration of prohibited substances. And that is obviously an issue, because if an athlete inadvertently or unintentionally administers a banned substance, he can test positive and be subject to discipline. That whole situation can certainly result in a long discussion on legal standards and burden of proof. But it's just something that presents challenges, because we have to administer our program with a high level of integrity. If a player violates our rules, we investigate and potentially impose sanctions or discipline as a result of that violation. But also, it gives you pause, because when you're talking about something that's unintentional, we want to do what we can to try to avoid those situations to the extent that we can. So that has required us to get into the world of, or at least consider the world of, third-party verification of dietary supplements. And while I feel that we're in a very strong place with respect to that, over the last 12 to 24 months, we have been made aware of not only contamination and high-risk products that are out there in the marketplace, but also low-risk products like multivitamins and electrolyte supplements and things that are very commonly used by not only our athletes, but all professional and amateur athletes. When you combine that with the greater sensitivity or the advancement on the equipment and procedures that are currently being used by our testing laboratories, a situation where banned substances can inadvertently end up in low-risk products that are commonly used with the ability to pick up banned substances at the laboratory creates a very challenging situation. So in addition to Major League Baseball, in my view, really taking the lead on the third-party verification front with respect to dietary supplements, we have also recently investigated the possibility of imposing or implementing thresholds on the drug testing front, or at least in the analytical front. And it's my understanding that other anti-doping entities like the World Anti-Doping Agency and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency are considering similar thresholds, just given the challenging landscape that the lack of regulation currently presents all of us.
Certainly. Well, John, this is a hugely important issue, and I'm really glad you brought it up. Can you give our listeners maybe a sense of the types of banned substance contaminants that are being found in some of these dietary supplements?
Sure. I mean, there are a number. We have certainly gotten involved in the investigation of what can be a contaminant in dietary supplements. We have seen everything from prohibited drugs of abuse, certainly to prohibited stimulants and energy products, but we've also even seen prohibited anabolic agents in over-the-counter supplements that can be available not only online, but also in regular nutrition stores in the United States. The most common challenge that we've seen recently is a class of substances called SARMs, or selective androgen receptor modulators. Those substances have been seen in a large number of over-the-counter products, and more so than we've seen in the past, SARMs have been found as contaminants in, like I said before, low-risk products that if you looked at the label or if you looked at the class of products that have been found in, there's really no red flags at all. So it just underscores the fact that everyone who uses supplements, but most importantly, athletes that are subject to anti-doping protocols, need to be incredibly cautious and careful with the over-the-counter dietary supplements that they consume.
Certainly. And I think in addition to these kind of inadvertent use issues that we've been discussing, there are a lot of communication issues within the field of anti-doping, and probably specifically in the work that you do, because I know your role involves a fair amount of connecting these other lawyers, other organizations, anti-doping professionals, as well as the public and the players. So is there something maybe that you deal with or encounter, a specific example of a concept or an idea that seems obvious in the work that you do, but that the public may often misunderstand?
Well, I think certainly the awareness and education of the general public on the risks associated with the dietary supplement industry is something that I would like to see improved for sure. But putting that subject aside for a second, The one misunderstanding that I think is important that the public understand, that there's two primary differences between Major League Baseball's anti-doping programs and, say, the Olympic programs that are in place. Not to say that one is better than the other, but there's just differences. And the one difference is the obligation that we have under U.S. federal law to collectively bargain or negotiate any changes to our Major League program with the Major League Baseball Players Association. Even if something sounds like a good idea, or even if we feel strongly about a potential change, We do not have the ability to unilaterally make that change without going through the negotiation process with the players' union and the players themselves. Now, even though that is an extra step, I feel very strongly that it's an important step because it's not just us unilaterally making a change that we feel is important. We have to collectively agree that we all want to make that change and that it's a good idea. Now, there has been a significant shift in our players' perspective over the last decade, and we've reached a very strong place with respect to these negotiations where not only are our players agreeing to the ideas that we bring to the table, but we've also had the wonderful experience of having the players and the players' union come to us with suggestions and ideas to improve our anti-doping program. So that's something that, while I don't know if there's a complete understanding of that process, it's something that I feel has resulted in significant improvements to our programs. The second difference, which is a long conversation, but in addition to our programs looking for performance-enhancing substances, testing our athletes, and there's unfortunately situations from time to time where discipline has to be imposed as a result of a violation involving a performance-enhancing drug. But our programs also have a pretty significant aspect to them that is on the treatment side. When we drug test our athletes, we are not just looking for performance-enhancing drugs. We are also looking for substances of abuse or drugs of abuse. And particularly with our major league program, but also with our significant minor league program, whenever a drug of abuse situation comes to light, either through a positive drug test or otherwise, we take the approach of trying to offer the player treatment and assistance. And while a lot of those situations are private and they do not result in public disclosure, I feel that they are a very important aspect of our program because these substances can be very detrimental to a player's career, but also can be very detrimental and problematic to a player's health and safety. And even though ultimately we sometimes have to get into the disciplinary world because of a violation of our rules, we first really try, and we have some wonderful consultants on staff that can assist us in this area, to offer the player treatment, to get him evaluated, to see what the issue is. And if a treatment program is warranted, we will impose that and oversee it to try to get the player on the right track and try to get him the help that he needs.
Certainly. Well, John, it sounds like you've had some great successes with both these negotiation of changes with players' unions, et cetera, as well as these drug treatment programs. And I think that's so important. And I love talking about success. So let's keep the conversation going here. Do you have a favorite success story from the work that you've done that you want to share with me and our listeners today?
Well, we've had our successes over the years, and the work that we've done is something that I'm very proud of. Certainly is a result of a lot of the time and effort that not only myself, but our entire team has applied to our anti-doping programs since they've been put in place. But taking it from a high level, I think really the success of our anti-doping programs over the last 10 or 12 years, something that I would like to share with you here today. When I was coming up through college and law school, and certainly a huge fan of Major League Baseball, there was a lot of criticism being communicated. Criticism from the federal government, criticism from the fans of our sports, criticism from other anti-doping agencies in saying that Major League Baseball was not doing enough on the anti-doping front. But in really a relatively short time, we have taken that criticism, taken it to heart, and imposed changes and negotiated changes that have really put us in a place of being in a leadership role on the anti-doping front. And while that is certainly partially a result of a lot of effort from the folks on our end and some great leadership from former Commissioner Bud Selig and current Commissioner Manfred, but it also is a big result of a shift in player perspective, as I mentioned before. Players are very outspoken. They want the strongest drug testing program, anti-doping program in place that we can to create a clean game and to give our fans confidence that baseball is being played the right way. But certainly a result of a collaboration with the Major League Baseball Players Association. We could not impose change without their agreement and through the negotiation process, but also suggestions and ideas that have come from that side of the bargaining table have put us in a place that we can certainly be proud of and I think is definitely a success. And at a time when, if you follow social media and you follow Twitter, we are in a place in the anti-doping history where Olympic athletes, global athletes are really speaking out. A number of them have said recently that they feel that they do not have a voice. But in our world, in the baseball world, our athletes actually have an obligation or really we have an obligation to bargain with them, and they certainly have a voice. And if they have ideas or suggestions on how to improve the anti-doping landscape, to improve the anti-doping programs and policies that we have in place, there is a method in place where they can bring that idea and suggestion to the table, and we will always be open to any sort of suggestion for improvement. So through all of that effort and through that structure that we have an obligation to follow, we've created effective and transparent policies that I can certainly be proud of, but I think can also serve as a model for other professional sports and anti-doping organizations that are looking to put good, strong policies in place.
Certainly. And actually, I was just going to ask that question. With the MLB being a role model in this anti-doping work that you're doing, are you finding now that other sport organizations are coming to you for ideas or assistance and trying to get their programs up and running?
Certainly. And my comments saying positive things about our programs is certainly not saying that other programs are not great as well. But we have great relationships with the other professional sports leagues in the U.S. and around the world. We meet with them regularly to talk about best practices. And while we may have experience and ideas that we can share with others, we can also learn from the others as well. And I think that collaborative approach among the leagues, among the anti-doping entities, have really improved the overall anti-doping landscape and put us all in a pretty good place. But certainly, we have been through some pretty extreme circumstances, whether it's the Mitchell investigation back in 2006, 2007, whether it's the Biogenesis investigation in 2013. Those were significant experiences that had a lot of learnings, and we're very open and willing to share not only the experience of having to go through that, but also the improvements that have resulted from those. And whether in small part or in large part, I think we have certainly taken a leadership role on this front and hopefully have shared our experiences with other organizations that have led to improvements in their world as well.
Excellent. Well, John, we've talked so far about a lot of the wonderful things that have sort of been done historically and are currently being done there at MLB and in the anti-doping community in general. But if you had all of the resources imaginable and there were no barriers, what is the one problem in sports law or the anti-doping field that you would most want to solve?
Well, it's tough to nail down one because I do feel strongly about making all the improvements that we can. And certainly, although we do not have unlimited resources, our commissioners over the years have been incredibly supportive of our work and incredibly generous because anti-doping, unfortunately, is not an inexpensive endeavor. I would have a hard time really nailing it down to one, but I can give you two if that's okay. First, as previously mentioned, the dietary supplement industry certainly presents challenges to drug-tested athletes. And if there was any way to clean up that through improved regulation, through lobbying of the government, I would certainly like to see improvements on that front because it's very challenging and very problematic when you even take away the adult athletes out of the conversation. As a parent of two young children, when you think about contaminants being in over-the-counter vitamins and nutritional products that are being used for good reason, frankly, it keeps me up at night to think that there can be problematic and dangerous contaminants in those types of products. So if we could do anything to clean up that industry, I would certainly be all for it. But specific to baseball, the other area that if I had unlimited resources, if I had my druthers, certainly on the government regulation side, I would turn our efforts to the governments in the Dominican Republic and Latin America, where a large number, about a third of our players come up through. And I would apply those resources to try to do what we can to make anabolic steroids illegal in those areas. Unfortunately, in those parts of the world, anabolic steroids like testosterone, spinazolol, nandrolone, boldenone are easily accessible. They are available for purchase without any sort of prescription. And as you can imagine, having access to those powerful anabolic steroids that do work, but will also cause a positive drug test, have presented us with significant challenges over the years. And while we've been very successful with our programs that are administered and conducted in the Dominican Republic and Latin America, we've seen a significant drop in the number of positive tests over the last decade, and we're very proud of that. That still means that these banned substances are available to amateur athletes. If a player is looking to get bigger, faster, stronger, it is not very difficult for him to seek out and obtain a banned substance that could improve his performance, certainly in an unethical and illicit way. In the United States, these are controlled substances that are illegal, but just the overall concern that they are very accessible and very obtainable is problematic for us on a variety of fronts. And I think if there was anything that we could snap our fingers and result in change, that would be something that I would certainly like to see.
Definitely. Well, John, thanks so much for talking about some of these big, almost bucket list dream projects that you have on your mind these days. And you've been very generous with your time and insights with us today. We're about to wrap up our call. Is there any last message you want to leave our listeners with today?
No, I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to talk about this. And hopefully we will be viewed as an example for the other anti-doping entities that are out there trying to make improvements in their respective sports.
Well, John, it was a pleasure speaking with you today. And listeners, wonderful to have you here with us as well. Now, get excited, listeners, because we have some phenomenal episodes coming up here featuring elite long-distance runner Paula Radcliffe, renowned anti-doping expert David Howman, leading global sports communication expert Ben Nichols, and much, much more. So stay tuned for our upcoming episodes. And I also want to give a big thank you to our episode sponsor, USANA, for supporting this episode of the Anti-Doping Podcast.